Today we're going to be talking about two different topics. We're going to be talking about copyrights and ownership of your drawings, and then we're going to be talking about proposal contracts, contracts that you can use when you're in business for yourself, and how they work and what their advantages and disadvantages are. First, let's deal with the issue of copyright and ownership of your own drawings. Typically, I get more questions on this topic than on any other that my clients ask me, and more misconception as well. Now, you have to understand what a copyright is or what it means to own a drawing. There are different kinds of property that the law recognizes. There's land or buildings on the land, which is called real property, real estate. Then there's almost everything else, which is called personal property, like your wristwatch, your car, your clothing. Anything that's not real estate tends to be personal property. And there are different sets of laws for them. But the kind of property we're going to be talking about with drawings is a third kind of property, different from the other two. It's called intellectual property. Intellectual property. And the major difference between it and other kinds of property is that it's intangible. It's not as if you can hold it in your hands or anything like that. When I talk about who owns the drawings, I'm not really referring to the piece of paper on which the drawing is printed. I'm referring to the right to use the intellectual material that comprises the drawings. And in the United States, that's governed by the U.S. Copyright Act. It's a federal statute, a national statute, so it's number two on the hierarchy of laws. It's similar to patent laws. You know what a patent is? When somebody makes a product and they invent it, so they want to make sure that it stays unique and nobody can copy it while they sell it. You know, drug companies do that before the generics are able to copy it. They get a patent for the product, and then they have a monopoly on that product for the length of the term of the patent. A patent is another kind of intellectual property. Copyright is an intellectual property that tends to refer to creative works or works of art. The U.S. has a Copyright Act, so does virtually every country in the world. And most of them have treaties with each other where they promise to abide by each other's intellectual property laws. A major exception tends to be in Southeast Asia, where you see knockoffs going on all the time. You hear about the Chinese or other people in Southeast Asia who are copying designer clothing and handbags and things like that and flooding the market with what are pretty close to identical copies, but cheaper, of these items, so that you know you can shoot a vendor on the street in New York with 100 purses laid out, all of which seem to look as if they're made by a particular designer. You can be pretty sure that that designer isn't selling through street vendors. And that means that those are probably knockoffs being made illegally. And there's not a whole lot you can do about it if the country that is allowing people to make the knockoffs pretty much turns a blind eye to it. As long as the people stay within that country's bounds, the knockoffs are going to happen. That generally isn't the case with drawings and specifications, with architectural drawings, because knockoffs just don't have the same kind of street value. Usually when you're dealing with somebody copying your drawing, it's a client who copies it for another location or a contractor who liked a house that you did and builds the same house somewhere else. Or it could be another architect who likes what he saw, intentionally or not, reproduces that in a drawing of his own. But all of those are different kinds of copyright violations that we'll be talking about. Now, copyrights are administered by a federal agency called the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. It's one of the few federal agencies that directly interacts with architects. Because it's a federal law, or a particular kind of federal law, there's exclusive jurisdiction in the federal courts for cases involving copyright infringement. You don't go to the Daily Center in Cook County if you're suing somebody for a copyright violation. You go to the federal district court that's also in the loop, but for the Northern District of Illinois, which is much more serious and a faster track as well to have those kinds of cases heard. So what can be copyrighted? I mean, what kinds of things are subject to intellectual property laws? Well, most people think that their concept is copyrightable, a unique idea, and that's wrong. Ideas themselves aren't capable of being copyrighted. What can be copyrighted is only the expression of the idea, which will incorporate the idea, but is more than just a mental concept. So for architecture, that means if you have some clever concept about room layout in a particular kind of building, and nobody's ever thought of it before, and it's more efficient or more desirable in some way, your idea all by itself isn't protectable. There's no right to uniqueness of ideas in the United States or in almost any other Western country. But the way you protect your idea is by drawing it up, by writing it up and creating a diagram that illustrates the idea. And it transforms the idea from just a mental concept to the expression of the idea. And it's that expression of the idea, the drawing, that's copyrightable. If you have an interesting tune running through your head that you think would be a huge hit, that's not copyrightable. But if you know music notation and can jot down the tune on a piece of paper, and you can have that piece of paper copyrighted as the expression of the song. Same thing if you have a great idea for a story. I've always had this wonderful idea for a novel in my head. The novel would be based on an alternative history. JFK's assassination is coming up to its 50th anniversary. Boy, I probably shouldn't be saying this out loud, should I? Because I think it's such a great idea. In any event, next year is November is the 50th anniversary, so I figured books about it would be hot sellers. And I always thought it would be really clever to write a book about what would have happened if the assassin who shot John F. Kennedy had missed by a little bit and shot Jackie instead. So the Jackie died, but John lived. And then the Warren Commission would have been named the Johnson Commission, because Johnson would still have been the vice president. And I'm not going to go into the details of it, but I've always thought it was a great novel. But now you can all steal it from me because it's not copyrightable, because it's just an idea. Or is it? I've got this silly microphone on, and that microphone is capturing what I'm saying. And what I'm saying is now the expression of my idea, very similar to if I had written it down as a plot summary or plot outline. So in fact, now that we're in the 21st century, the courts have begun to realize that there are ways of capturing or writing down an idea that isn't just writing it on paper. It may be a video or an audio a representation of the idea. I mean, if I were a musician and I had a great song running through my head, I could play it on the piano and record what I'm playing, and the audio file would presumably be the expression of that idea every bit as much as the musical notation and notes on a piece of paper. So emails or maybe in the future holograms or whatever it might be could end up being the expression of these ideas. But for now, the primary expression is a piece of paper on which a drawing is printed, or possibly a CAD file that contains the digital equivalent of that piece of paper, all of which would be deemed to be expressions of the idea. However, when you submit the idea for copyright, you have to submit it in a way that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office can understand. Just as when you submit a set of drawings for a building permit, you have to submit it in a way that the municipal building department can understand. And unfortunately, they can't read a BIM file, so you have to submit your plans in two-dimensional representations. Similarly, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office really isn't set up to read an electronic file or to read a CAD file. They probably have the software and could do it if they were to bother to spend the time, but they're functionaries and bureaucrats. So they have detailed regulations about what you have to submit to have your drawings copyrighted. And those copyrights, the copyright requirement is really that it be on a piece of paper of some kind, so it works with their filing system. Ownership, classifications of ownership. The AIA documents refer to your drawings and specifications as instruments of service. That's a term of art, instruments of service. What that means is that you're not being hired to produce a product that's being paid for. It's not like you are a manufacturer and the client is paying you for the goods you're manufacturing, and then the client owns those goods. The concept of instrument of service means that you are being hired to perform a service, and the drawings are the method by which you do that service or communicate that service. It's not the product itself. And when you have a situation where instruments of service are being required, that is another way of saying that the architect retains ownership of the intellectual property. The owner is not buying the intellectual property from you. The owner is simply hiring you to perform a service and is acknowledging that the ownership of the ideas remains yours. Now contrast that with a term that's sometimes used in some contracts called works for hire. Works for hire. Works for hire is the product concept. That says that there's a deal going on where you're being asked to produce a set of drawings, and the owner is buying the drawings and all the rights to use those drawings from you. It's not really a service so much that's being hired. It's really the product. And that's perfectly doable. There's nothing wrong or illegal about it. It simply is a different way of doing business, where the owner is succeeding to all of the rights in the drawings. Question? Very good question. If the owner owns the intellectual property in the drawings, does that mean that the architect's not allowed to reproduce them himself for some other client? And the answer is yes. That the architect is doing a one-off, in a sense. That this is a concept for the client that the client's going to be investing a lot of advertising or marketing or money in some way, and the client doesn't want a substantially similar concept being used by any competitors or anybody else. It makes sense. An example of somebody who has a real investment in an architectural concept is McDonald's. When McDonald's hired the original architect to design the golden arches, as they called them, that was the symbol for the product. It's become a trademark and a whole bunch of other advertising, marketing advantages for McDonald's. If the architect who designed those golden arches was allowed to design golden arches for Burger King and Wendy's and all the competitors or other fast food places, there'd be all kinds of confusion and McDonald's would lose out. The money that McDonald's spends to market these arches in some way is going to be wasted or at least used in part to benefit competitors, and McDonald's doesn't want that. Another example, a little more subtle example of an organization that wants to own its design would be, say, Walgreens. Walgreens is a drugstore that has stores in every city in the country. They must have thousands and thousands of stores. Any of you ever been inside a Walgreens, I assume? You've probably been inside more than one. I'll bet after the first time you were in one, you found yourself able to navigate your way around virtually any of them, because they all had the same basic setup, the same location of aisles, the same shelves around the perimeter, the same things in the same locations. And that's kind of an interior design subset of architecture that Walgreens wants unique to Walgreens. Not so much because they're afraid competitors will take it, but because they want the right to reuse that element of the design over and over again in all of their stores to increase customer comfort. You know when you walk into a Walgreens, you'll be able to figure out where things are because it's the same in all of them. So people are more likely to walk into a Walgreens than some competitive drugstore because they feel comfortable with it, or at least that's the marketing concept. And your architecture, then, needs to be owned by Walgreens so that they can reuse it time and time and time again. Now, who owns the intellectual property, the drawings and specs, or the copyright in them in a typical architectural agreement? Well, it depends on what the agreement says. Ownership of the documents or of any element of the documents is pretty much a function of what the contract says. The contract can make the architect the owner or can make the owner the owner. It can even have joint ownership, where they both have the right to reuse. A question I frequently get is, well, what happens if the contract is silent on that? Or if it was a verbal contract and nobody happened to talk about ownership of the intellectual property? Well, there's a default position, which means that it's the position that the law would take if there isn't any agreement to the contrary. And that is, fortunately for you, the artist owns the art. Or in your case, the architect owns the architecture. So if your contract for your services is silent on the issue of ownership of the copyright, well, then you own it, not the owner. The owner may not understand that, but that's what the law actually is. Ownership of the copyright, however, isn't the last piece of analysis. The key is who has the right to use the drawings. And there you have to understand the legal concept of a license. Now, everybody's a little bit familiar with the idea of a license because probably everybody here owns one. You all have driver's licenses, probably. You may probably have license plates on your cars or whatever. But the bottom line is that a license is just a bundle of rights. It's the right to do something. Don't confuse the card that we call the driver's license with the legal concept of a license. The driver's license card is really just the certificate that reflects the fact that you have a license to drive. And that license allows you to do certain things. That's like a license for your drawings as well. Even if you own the copyright to your drawings, the owner almost certainly has a license to use them for certain purposes. And the license is also a function of the contract. The license will be described in the contract. And if you remember the B101 form, it goes into a great deal of detail about exactly what the owner's license is for and how long it lasts and on what grounds it terminates. It's just part of the deal. And you can define a license any way you want. Now, it's almost universal that the client's license to use your drawings extends at least for the project you created them for. The client generally has the right to reproduce the drawings, copy them, make copies for the contractors for bidding, for the subcontractors for their bidding, for the municipal building department to get a building permit, and all other kinds of uses that are necessary for the project. Now, does the owner have the right to copy the drawings to send them to a magazine for publicity? Maybe or maybe not. It depends on what the document says. Does the owner have the right to copy the drawings and reuse them for a different project in a different location? Well, probably not, but again, it depends on what the contract says. One of my first cases, I think I told you about, was an architect who designed a single-family residence in Arizona, in the desert area, with a flat roof, which makes sense because there's not a whole lot of precipitation in the desert. And the structure for it was more than adequate to support a roof that didn't have a lot of things accumulating on it. But the owners, who liked the design of the house so much, decided and were kind of snowbirds who would be in Arizona in the wintertime and lived in Wisconsin in the summertime, built a copy of the house without telling this architect, just gave it to a builder in Wisconsin to build, and the roof collapsed from the weight of the snow, because it wasn't designed structurally to support the weight of the snow. And there was a claim made against the architect for negligent structural design for a roof that collapsed. But of course, that was caused by using the roof in a place it wasn't intended to. And I think I told you about it initially because it was a description of what's negligent and what's not, what's foreseeable and what's not. But it's also an interesting illustration of how the owner improperly used the drawings in violation of the license to create the identical house in a different location. He did not have the right to do that, and it was a copyright violation for him to do so. Can the owner reuse the drawings for an addition to this project? You design project A, and a few years later, the owner needs to expand again and wants to authorize project B and to use your drawings to allow the new architect who's doing project B to create something that's complementary to your design. Does he have the right to do that? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. It depends on what the contract says. The contract could very well say that it can only be used for this project, period. Or it could say, as it frequently does, or the owner may use it for future projects on the same site or for maintenance of the existing project, but only if he defends and indemnifies the original architect from any claims that might arise out of reusing the drawings for a second project. That's frequently a compromise that's struck when you're negotiating the contract, where the owner wants to have the right to reuse the drawings, and the architect doesn't want to be subjected to liability all over again for a second project that he's not been hired for. Now, this license that we're talking about the owner having is another kind of intellectual property. It's a concept, but it doesn't have a certificate that gets issued to commemorate the license. I mean, your driver's license is a certificate, and that's given to you, you know, for identification purposes more than anything else. But once you pass the driver's exam and all the other prerequisites, you have a right to drive, even if you don't have a license, even if the license burned up. So the certificate itself doesn't really make a lot of difference. The license to use your drawings is even more intangible than that. There's no such thing as a certificate for that license. The license is just a function of what the contract says. So how do you get a copyright in your drawings? Well, there are different ways, and in fact, the law recognizes different levels of copyrights and different consequences. The certain way, or at least the best way, to get a copyright of one of your drawings is to submit the drawing to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. There's a form you fill out. You attach the drawings. I don't know what information you have to put into it because I don't recall ever having done that myself. But you then submit it to them, and they somehow examine it for uniqueness to make sure it's not a knockoff of something that somebody else did. Don't ask me how. I don't think that there's really any sensible way to do that. I think they mostly take your word for it. And then we'll issue a formal letter of copyright to you to confirm that it's copyrighted. Now, that can be challenged, and it happens in patent cases all the time. A company creates a product, submits it for a patent, and gets it, and keeps that patent, and then tries to keep all competitors out of the market. But some other company says, we really had this idea before you did, so your patent shouldn't be valid as to us. And they then go to court to try to prove prior, I forget the exact term, but prior design of the product or prior invention of whatever it is that was patented. And if they can prove in court that they came first, then the patent is invalidated. So even if you get a letter from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office saying that your drawings are hereby copyrighted, it's possible that some other architect could invalidate the copyright by proving that he had designed the same thing that you did, but first, and that you either copied his or else you just fortuitously invented the same concept that he had independently himself, even without copying, but he was still prior in time to you. Another way to have a copyright is simply to give notice to the outside world of your intent to copyright it. In other words, you can go and apply for a copyright after you've come to suspect that somebody's copying you. The smart way to do that is by putting a copyright notice right on the face of your drawings. Over here I wrote on the board, a C, and for those of you who are just listening and didn't show up to class today, there's a little C in a circle followed by 2012 by ABC Architects, Inc. And you've probably seen that. You've probably seen it on the cover page of a book or something else, even on the bottom of an official drawing. It is a notice to the outside world that you intend to claim copyright ownership of the drawing. It's not a copyright all by itself, but it can be turned into one if you've been infringed on by sending it in to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And there's some argument that there's a common law right to a copyright just by giving notice. Not a statutory right that the U.S. government recognizes, but something less that the courts will recognize in the common law, which is the fifth level on our hierarchy of laws. But the basic rule for all of you is whenever you create a unique drawing or concept or something like that that you're expressing, you should always put this notice, this little C in a circle, which is the shorthand for copyright, on the bottom of the cover page. It doesn't have to be on every page, but it should be on a page that somebody will see, which usually means the cover page. And what it does is it officially tells the rest of the world that you claim this work as your own. And that means that if they do copy it, there are more serious consequences than if you didn't put that on there. Well, because the architect's stamp doesn't have any effect on copyright law. Your stamp or your seal has a different purpose. It's a function of state law. The only reason you have a seal or a stamp as an architect is that a state law, the Architecture Practice Act, requires an architect to stamp and seal every set of drawings for something that's going to be constructed, basically to show that it was done and approved by a licensed architect so that it will be reasonably safe. And drawings that are submitted for permit are almost always required to be stamped and sealed as proof that they've been done by an architect so that the building department can rely on your knowledge and expertise to having designed something that is reasonably safe. But it's a function of state law safety issues. It has nothing to do with copyright issues. And in fact, somebody could copy your drawings, submit them for a building permit with their own seal on it, and it doesn't mean that they've copyrighted it. It simply means that they're telling the public entity that they drew it, designed it, and checked it to make sure that it meets all legal requirements. So a seal, yeah, has a different purpose.
If I could add one thing. If you guys imagine, while putting the notice of the C with the circle is something that is recommended, so you do affirmatively put people on notice. Under the, there's actually was an amendment to the Copyright Act, the Architectural Works and Copyright Act of 1990. It states that you actually do not have to have the shield, the C with the circle, to still own a copyright in it. You can imagine when an artist paints a picture, they don't put a little C in the circle in the bottom corner of some picture. They still own a copyright in that. But the copyright circle, the C with the circle, is a recommendation, very strong recommendation, to put everybody on notice that that is what you've copyrighted. And as Mark said, if you don't send it in to register right away or you don't have that C, at any point in the future you can send it in and have your copyright registered. That has some impacts on how a lawsuit may transpire and what your defenses are. But you will have the copyright without that C, but I don't recommend not putting it.
Thanks, Mike, and that's correct. This is a notice. It's not something that's statutorily required. What kind of protection does the Copyright Act give you? Well, it gives you a lot of different protections, and the protection is against a concept called infringement. Infringement is when somebody illegally copies your drawing or whatever else, whatever other piece you've got copyrighted. And the infringement can happen in any one of three ways. It can be intentional infringement. You know, the knockoffs in Southeast Asia are intentional infringement. Somebody is trying to copy somebody else's design in order to make money off it. They know they're copying and they're doing it purposely. A second kind of infringement is called negligent infringement. That's when you don't do a sufficient investigation of what else is out there to determine whether what you're doing is unique. Everybody who's drawing something is legally required to survey the field of what else similar has been drawn to make sure that they're not inadvertently copying something that they may have seen years ago and are remembering as an idea, but not remembering they saw. How you do that, I have no idea. I don't think it's possible to do. You'll have a sense of certain things that are that other people have done, but there's no way you can survey the field of everything that's been designed. The third way that somebody can infringe a copyright is unintentionally, or I guess it's accidentally. And that's where you do a reasonable survey of the field, and you don't find anything, and you go ahead and do your drawing, and it turns out that somebody obscure that you really couldn't have logically found had beaten you to it, and what you have done turns out to be substantially the same as what they've done. You may have seen it when you were a kid and liked the idea and not remembered it in your conscious memory and have no way of finding it again. Now, that happens less in architecture than in other things. In music, it happens a lot. You guys familiar with the late George Harrison of the Beatles? Are you aware that he was sued for copyright infringement for the Beatles song, My Sweet Lord? And he lost. It turns out that it was so similar to a 1950s rock song that he was found to have copied substantial portions of it. Now, almost certainly not intentionally. You know, he grew up in the 50s, and he heard some tune that that resonated with him. And when he was writing music for the Beatles, that tune came to his mind, and he wrote it down and thought it was unique. But it apparently wasn't. This happened to Michael Jackson about 10 years ago, I think. Was it Thriller, do you remember? Was that the song that he was accused of copyright infringement? I'm not certain, but I believe he lost that trial, too. And again, not intentionally. It's not as if he was a bad person trying to steal anybody's ideas. It was just that the jury found that he probably heard it sometime in the past and unconsciously copied it. And those kinds of things can happen. It happens with books sometimes when somebody takes the plot or has some story in mind and doesn't realize that they heard it or read it, you know, years ago when they were kids or whatever. So it's easy to happen in that kind of creative endeavor. It may happen in architecture too. It's just harder to trace because there really isn't the same archive of previous architectural designs. You may have had a neighbor who had a fantastic-looking house when you were a kid, and that idea has stuck with you, and you can't remember the house if you were asked to, but when you create one that you like a lot, it may turn out to be substantially like that neighbor's house, and therefore you're accidentally copying as well. Now, one of the requirements of infringement is that there be copying. If two people independently come up with the same design, or the same creative endeavor, that's not infringement. Infringement requires at least this accidental or innocent level, that's probably a better word for it, innocent level of copying. That's hard to prove. How do you prove what George Harrison heard in the 1950s? I mean, you can play the song for the jury, the two songs for the jury, and you can let them listen to how similar they are, but how do you prove that George Harrison actually heard this as a kid? Because if he did hear it as a kid, then by kind of definition, it's copying, even if it was totally innocent and he wasn't even aware of remembering it. And it's the same for you. If you've seen something or been impressed by something and end up producing it, that can be copying as well. But if if there were two students in this class who had different projects that they were doing for a class, and just by coincidence happened to come up with virtually identical projects, it doesn't mean that either one copied from the other. It is possible, given a set of constraints, that two people may have independently designed virtually identical things. Unlikely, but possible. And proving copying remains one of the elements of an infringement claim, which makes it hard. Although the court will allow a jury to infer copying from a set of circumstances, which makes it a lot easier. Excellent question. The question is, how much or how closely does something have to be copied in order to constitute infringement? That's the question that the courts have to ask themselves. And I can't give you an answer to that, at least not one that's got any definiteness to it. There has to be enough copying so that the essence of the idea has been copied. But it doesn't have to be identical. I mean, for songs, if you have a whole passage of one that duplicates another, that's probably enough. But, you know, there's a limited number of musical notes that if you just put enough of them in sequence long enough, you're going to have strings that are exactly the same as a string of notes from some other song. You've probably had the experience yourself of hearing the beginning of an introduction to a song, thinking it's a different song, and finding out, whoa, these two songs had pretty much the same introduction. It happens, and it's not necessarily copying. So the bottom line is that it's a very unclear rule of thumb that a court will apply. Has it been copied substantially enough to be a knockoff of the design or a knockoff of a critical element of the design? And that's pretty much the test that's used. in part, what the courts actually do is to apply the level of innocence as part of this analysis. If the claim is innocent copyright infringement, then a court's going to usually require a tremendously close copy before they'll find infringement. But if the claim is intentional infringement, where they're trying to do a knockoff, then the court's not going to have to find the same degree of copy in order to find copying. In other words, the infringer might say, yeah, the products look similar on the outside, but I made this one with a much cheaper fabric than what the designer actually uses. And the court's going to say, no way, you were trying to copy this design and to do it cheaply to make a profit at it. You wanted it to look substantially like the other one, and the cheapness of the fabric is secondary to the looks, which is what you were trying for, and therefore you're guilty. So the degree of guilt in the infringement process plays a role in figuring out how much infringement there has to be.
One other thing that I think is relevant, and Mark will be covering in a minute, that's relevant to what you guys do. There are many, many things that you're going to draw. You're going to draw over and over and over. A standardized detail that you're going to use in almost every space and building of how you do connections or door frame or whatever. That is not what it's called an original expression of the idea. So standardized details actually are not copyrightable. What becomes copyrightable sometimes is how you take the standardized details and put them together. So when your question is how much needs to be copied, you might actually have people that are copying many things on your drawings, but it's not an infringement because you don't own that copyrighted and standard detail. So it's the courts also look at, in addition to what Mark said about the level of innocence and everything else, they look at the original product that's being copyrighted or being claimed to being infringed, and they say, how much of that is an original expression of the idea, and then what did the copy take that was original from the first one?
Good point, Mike. Related to that is another way that you can express your design intent. We were talking about drawings or CAD file or maybe a hologram or something like that. A common way that an architectural intent or design is expressed is in a building. The building itself is the expression of the architectural design. So even if somebody erected a building without using drawings or blueprints or anything like that at all, some contractor just built it for himself, if it copies a copyrighted architectural design, namely another building, that all by itself can be a copyright infringement. So the actual construction project itself may be the infringement, not just the drawings that are the basis for it. So what's the consequence of infringement? What happens? Or another way of asking is, what remedies does the designer have when somebody else infringes on his or her design? Well, one of the interesting things you can do is that you can go to court and you can get an injunction. Do you remember injunction from our contracts remedies class? That's a court order that requires or forbids something. You can get an injunction to stop a construction project. Because the building itself is the expression of your idea, you can go to court and say, my idea is unique. I'm going to be irreparably harmed if somebody else is able to express it by building a building using it. So I want you to stop the construction before it infringes my design. And if you can prove that it's your copyrighted design that's been used without permission, without a license, then you can actually get an order stopping a project in its tracks. And that's a huge threat to whoever's building the building, because it essentially is financially ruinous. You stop a project in the tracks and make it just stand still, waiting for a court case to be fought out, whoever's building it's going to lose a fortune while paying back construction loans and things like that, and will give in to almost whatever demand you have. Now, most of the time, the issue doesn't actually involve a building in progress. Most of the time, it's an issue of money. It's an issue of wanting to be paid for somebody who uses your work without permission, something like that. And there are two different measures of damages that you can seek when your drawing has been infringed. One is lost profits. Very much an expectation kind of concept. Remember expectation damages that put you back in the same position you would have been in but for the breach? Because your objection in most situations where you're suing for money isn't so much that your work is being infringed and the building is being built without you designing it. It's that the owner didn't hire you to produce the drawings to build the building. Because you would have let him build the building with your design if he'd hired you to do it. That's what your job is. So you should be able to sue to be put back in the position you would have been in if he had hired you to produce this design instead of hiring somebody else to copy it. Well, what puts you back in that position? The profits you would have made from the project, right? If you would have made a profit of $10,000 for being able to reuse your design for this project, then you've been hurt by $10,000 by the owner hiring somebody else to do it. And that's your lost profits. That's one of the things you're allowed to sue for when you have your drawings infringed upon. Sometimes, however, it's hard to figure out whether you'd have any profits or lost profits. I mean, the profit margin for an architectural shop is pretty small. I mean, the profits you make on a project of, you know, after you pay your expenses and things like that for doing the work are relatively tiny. So suing for lost profits may result in you winning the case, but winning a tiny amount of money. So the U.S. Copyright Act allows you to sue for statutory damages. Statutory damages. Those are the amounts of money set forth in the statute as being awardable by a court if somebody has infringed. And how much is that? Well, I can't remember the numbers, but there are three different levels of damages based on the three levels of innocence. That there's a much higher damage award for intentional infringement. It's a range that the judge chooses. There's a medium range for negligent infringement and a lower range for innocent infringement. But almost all the time, those numbers are higher than the lost profits that you'd be able to prove up if you just sued for lost profits. That's pretty much the law of copyright. Any questions or anything like that? Well, say you were somebody who wanted to use a portion of a Michael Jackson song, and you weren't going through proper channels. You were just going to record it. Michael Jackson could go to court. Well, he used to be able to go to court. And his estate could go to court and stop you, get an injunction stopping you from recording it or stopping the radio stations from playing it, because that's reproducing the song. Or he could sue you for money damages for the profits you made from the song, or depending on your level of innocence, for the statutory damages. Often they sue you for a lot of money and then reach a settlement with you where you agree, or the infringer agrees, not to do it anymore, never to record the song again or to play it again, and to pay some amount of money. Because they're more interested usually in establishing their ownership than in whatever money damages that they may be able to earn. Now that doesn't mean you can never reproduce something. There are certain exceptions to the Copyright Act which are called fair use. Fair use means that anyone who puts something into the public domain is given up the right to have it discussed academically. So if you're featuring it in a textbook or in a critical article or something like that, you can show a photograph of the building. And even though that's an expression of the architectural design, in almost any article, it's fair use. Some articles will require you to get permission from the architect if it's a publicity article. But in that case, the architect's happy to give permission. They want the publicity. Another fair use is commentary or Saturday Night Live. They do a takeoff on somebody's song and change a few of the words to make fun of it, but use the same melody and the same harmony. And that's fair use because satire is considered a fair use of somebody else's work product. It's a type of criticism. And if you put intellectual property into the marketplace, you are allowing it to be criticized. So it's not every single use of a design that's infringement, but it's reuse of the design with the intent to reprofit from it as a new design that would be considered infringement, which is most of the copying that you'd be concerned about. I want to talk about a second subject today. We won't spend a lot of time on it. But if you look, most of you have already printed out the lecture notes for today from my website. Those of you who haven't probably should, because there's something very valuable on there. And that's this proposal letter contract that's up on the board here. I may have given you the impression from going through the B101 and A201 contract documents that most contracts take the form of formal written things that lawyers have gone through with deeply numbered paragraphs and subparagraphs and signature lines and all that craziness. And those are contracts, but they're not the only kind of contract. And in fact, I recommend to a lot of my clients that instead of or prior to using one of the standard AIA forms, they use a letter agreement instead. Let me explain to you the system or the way business works that's caused me to make that recommendation. I call it the developer delay. Developers, private developers, are notoriously underhanded. If John Maxey were here, he could give you chapter and verse about how crooked they are, and how they will go to all kinds of lengths to get something for nothing or for less than it's worth. What frequently happens is that a developer approaches an architect and describes a project that he has in mind, and the architect is thrilled. It looks like a great job, financially wonderful, and strokes the architect's ego that this impressive developer is coming to that architect interested in that architect's design. So the architect is happy to cooperate with the developer to start the project as quickly as possible and to cement his position in it. So the developer gets the architect to start working on programming and schematic type drawings, concept drawings, and then tells the architect to submit a proposal. And the architect submits a proposal, and it describes the scope of work and fees and stuff like that. And the developer stalls after reading it a little bit, and weeks or even a month or two has gone by, and the developer says, you know, your proposal is fine, but the bank is requiring me to have it in the form of a contract. So would you do up a standard B101 contract and submit that? And the architect takes a week or so, but has the lawyer do it and submits the contract and doesn't hear from the developer for a while. Then the architect calls the developer and says, I need my contract signed and back. I've got to start invoicing. And the developer says, oh, yeah, I'll get to it. It was just buried in my inbox. And more time passes, and the architect calls again. And this time the developer's excuse is, well, I gave it to my lawyer, and I haven't heard back from him. I'll get back to you. And he doesn't. And the contract sits there a long time. And then after months, the contract comes back marked up by a lawyer with a host of impossible changes, changes that the architect can't possibly agree to, and the architect doesn't know what to do. He's into the project so deeply this time, so much time invested, so much work done that he can't walk away. He'd lose his shirt if he does. So now he's kind of screwed where the developer has most of the bargaining leverage because the architect needs the job and the developer hasn't agreed to any terms yet. Well, I don't like that situation for my architect clients, but it happens frequently. Sometimes without even intending. Sometimes the architect fails to follow up and the client doesn't understand that he's got to act on the proposal or there's no contract in place. So I teach my architect clients when they're in that situation, they're first approached for the job, to have a standardized proposal letter on their hard drive where all they have to do is to fill in the project-specific ideas or information, and to be able to send that out. And what I have here is an example of a client of mine who's no longer in business, so he doesn't mind his work product here being passed out. But I wanted to show it to you and to go through the ideas behind it, because I want this proposal letter set up so that if nobody ever does anything more, it becomes the contract, so that there's a contract in place automatically, even if it's never superseded by a formal B101 type document. So the key, this proposal letter serves that function, but it serves a second function as well, and an important function, and that is educating the client. Most claims against architects occur because of disappointed expectations in the client. The client thinks they're supposed to get something and they don't get it. The beginning of the relationship is a honeymoon period where the architect and the client get along like that. But as the architect has to do things that the client would prefer not to have done but that the project requires, or if the architect isn't perfectly responsive, or even for the client's whim, often the relationship splits and there's a little bit more hostility or at least wariness between the parties. The purpose of this letter is not only to educate the client, but then to prove later on that the client has been educated and explained how the project's supposed to work. For instance, the client may think that one of your jobs as the architect is to design and design and design again until he's happy. As many different design concepts as it takes until he's happy. And that's not right. You'd lose your shirt doing that. You have a certain reasonable number, often a finite, quantified number of design alternatives in your contract, but not over and over again. So this proposal letter has the function of being the education to the client about how a project's supposed to occur. And that's important, because you presumably, in your professional career, are going to do tens or hundreds, maybe even thousands of projects. But your client may only be doing this one, or just one or two, and won't know the industry and what's supposed to happen the way that you do. So ideas that are perfectly clear to you, he may never have thought of. And it's incumbent on you to educate the client. So, the beginning of this proposal letter is, you see, this is set up like an agreement here. What I would prefer to see, and what the letter really does, is sets it up with, "Dear client," or "Dear John Smith," or whatever it is, "please allow this letter to be my formal proposal for architectural services for the project." Now, part of what this letter is supposed to do is to sell. You want to describe your services in a way that he will enjoy reading them, because they will make him feel good about his project. And where you have to put protective provisions in there, you want them de-emphasized, which means you want them later in the document and not highlighted for the owner to focus or emphasize on. So you start this out like a friendly letter. You want to be on the client's side. So you express your excitement about the project, how interesting it is, what a grand concept they have, and how you're going to look forward to creating it with them as a mutual endeavor. All this nice flowery language that's intended to create solidarity and otherwise doesn't have any real legal meaning. And then once you spend a paragraph or two with the flowery language, then you get into, boy, that's loud, then you get into the scope descriptions. So one section, and you don't have to label this Roman numeral 1. I'm just doing this for your ease of understanding. It just may be that the next paragraph, without any numbers or labeling at all, starts to talk about your understanding of the description of the project. You provide a detailed scope description. Why is that? Well, because owners are notoriously fickle. They may change their mind or believe that the scope description they have in mind on day 10 is the same that they had in mind on day 1, when in reality the project's expanded and you have more work to do than you originally bid on. So this memorializes your understanding of the project scope, mostly so that if or when it increases, you can seek an additional fee to pay for the additional scope of work. Then the next section, a big Roman numeral 2, is to go through the architectural design process to explain how it works. And this goes into programming and code review. And not every project will, so not everything that's in here will be part of every project. Then it talks about the architectural survey and explains why you need it and what you will do to help create as-builts or drawings you're going to be working from. It talks about schematic design and what that design consists of. This architect had cost estimating at every portion of the job, so the next step was to do an estimate of cost and a projection of schedule based on the schematic drawings. Notice that it says that the client approval in writing of the estimate of the total construction budget at the end of the schematic phase will be the end of that schematic phase and constitute approval to go on to the design development phase. And then paragraph 5 talks about design development and what's involved and spells it out for the client in more detail than you would need to understand. Section 6 talks about the process of preparing construction documents. Section 7 talks about the bidding or permitting process and goes through everything that happens there. Section 8 talks about contract administration. This is during construction what you will do to administer the construction contract. And notice that in paragraph 8 it refers to the general conditions section below, which we're going to be stopping and talking about. Now, this architect calls his business terms and conditions general conditions. I guess that's an okay title for them. You don't have to call them that. You could call them the business terms or the details or whatever other label you want to put. The key is that you have a section that talks about the business terms that are going to exist in the contract. And this client happened to be an interior designer as well as an architect. So phase 9 of the project suggested interior design services and made it clear that they would be extra, additional services, not basic. So after you've spent several pages, as this architect did, going through a description of the entire architectural process, they then go on to what's Roman numeral 3 here, which would simply be the next section of your proposal letter, the description of fees. You know, section 1 talks about small projects where the fee is hourly. And notice it also says that, it doesn't say here, but this is also for projects where you can't really determine scope or prior to scope being determined. In section 2, which is an architectural fee for all other projects, it says that there will be design services provided on an hourly basis without a cap until the design has been explored and finalized. And then it quotes a design fee, or a fee actually, for the rest of the project after the hourly billing, which is pre-scope determination. This architect charged 8% of the total cost of construction as his lump sum architectural fee for all of the services after scope was determined. Now that's low for upper-end residential design, but as you'll see, this architect excludes the engineers from it. So the owner will be hiring the engineers directly, and therefore that fee doesn't come out of the architect's side. The engineers usually earn approximately one-third of the total fee, so the owner will probably be paying 4% of the cost of construction to the various engineers that he has to hire. And the section on fees goes down to break it down by percentages over the various phases of the project so that the owner knows what kind of billing to expect, so that the owner's bank, who issues a construction loan based on this proposal, will see in advance what the outlays are going to be and can't claim to be surprised. Paragraph 3 here has a concept that you would be well advised to consider. It's the concept of a retainer. Now, professionals often take retainers when performing services for their clients that they bill after the fact for. What is a retainer? Well, a retainer is like a down payment. It's a payment made before the services start, and it's for the purpose of being secure in payment. You hold it throughout the job, and you apply it to your last services at the end of the job. So you are being billed and paid on a current basis, but you're holding that money to the end of the job because it's common for a client to skip out on paying the last architect invoice or two. Why is that? Well, because he can get away with it. Because it's not enough money to justify you hiring me and going to court. And therefore, developers in particular are famous for skipping their architect at the end of the job simply because they can and they can get away with it. So a retainer is a way that you're holding the money for that last invoice or two throughout the project, and when you issue the last couple of invoices, you credit the money you're holding against them so that the developer doesn't have to pay it again. Then the contract has reimbursable expenses and a description of additional services. You see that these additional services are suggestions, and there's an interesting line at the end. You see where it says, other services not included in sections 1 through 7? That's a catch-all phrase, and that's a smart way to do things. Owners like to do the opposite. Owners like to say that your basic services for the project will consist of all the different phases of design and construction and anything else that's not specifically identified as an additional service. Well, that's a bad idea, at least from your standpoint, because that means if you omitted to list something weird as an additional service because it was too weird to bother putting in the contract, that sentence would mean that it would be a basic service that you have to do for the fee you've already quoted. This is a more appropriate line. It says things that are so unusual that we didn't think to even put them in the contract. If you want me to do those services too, that's an additional service for additional fee. Then the architect has a section on changes in the project scope. That's his section 6. And that's an education section more than anything else. You'll see that the architect explains that size, quality, or time of the project may change from commencement in the original assumptions to the end of the job. And that an architect's fee is calculated based on knowing all three of these specifics. So if any of them should change by the end of the project, then the architect's fee will need to be equitably adjusted. It's a lot easier to convince your client of the need to pay you more for a scope change like this if you spelled it out in advance with the initial proposal you made. Because you can sit down with them and say, you know, I told you about this at the very beginning before we even knew that this would occur. This is a basic part of architecture, which is why I put it in the proposal. And when I calculated my fee, it was on the basis of assuming that these kinds of things would be extra, or else I'd have had to charge you more originally to insure against these kinds of things happening. So you can use this as an education tool to teach your client why it's fair for him to be paying you more when the project increases in scope. Sure. I'd say we're 15 minutes away from finishing. You're welcome to stay for that, or you're welcome to come back. Okay, thanks. Sorry about the timing. Section 7's on invoicing and payment. Now that's something that you stick in the middle, near the end of this part of the proposal, because, you know, how many clients will read through the proposal really carefully from beginning to end? They're going to start by reading the beginning, and they're going to like what they see because it's all flowery language. Then they're going to read all the details of how the architecture works, and they'll be interested by that. But odds are they're going to be paying less attention to the proposal the longer it goes on, and they'll start to skip through it faster. So the parts that you don't want to have to justify to them that are more in your favor and adversarial to them, you want to put in the middle and later part of the proposal letter. It's just basic sales technique. So Section 7 on invoicing and payment is shortly before you get into the boilerplate general conditions. And it says that there will be interest at the rate of 1.5% per month on late payments. There's a reason for that. Now, that's a high interest rate. That's 18% per year, credit card type interest rate. But the reason you do that is so that your client doesn't have an incentive not to pay you on time. There are some clients who put ridiculously low interest rates in their contract, like the prime rate, which is the lowest rate you can go to a bank and borrow from if you are Microsoft. And if that's the rate, then you know what your clients are going to do? They're going to delay paying you, which is the same thing as you making a loan to your client of the money that he owes to you to work with at a ridiculously low interest rate because you'd have to pay more to borrow your working capital from the bank. So you need a high interest rate to incentivize the client to pay you and to turn to somebody else with lower interest rates to borrow from. There's also a look at attorney's fees clause at the end of Section 7 here that says that if you have to go to court or something like that to enforce your right to payment, that he not only has to make the payment to you, but he has to pay you for all your legal fees as well. Because remember how ridiculously expensive I am or other lawyers are? We talked about this the first week. If you have to collect $10,000, I don't know that a lawyer can do it for you very cost effectively because the legal fees may eat up all or most of that. So this allows you to sue for even relatively small amounts, because if you spend $25,000 in legal fees to collect $10,000, you're okay because the judgment's going to be $35,000 because you're going to be awarded your legal fees back as well. Roman numeral 4 talks about consultants. Consultants include not just a surveyor or somebody who's helping the owner or a construction manager or somebody like that. Consultants include all of the engineers. It lists civil, structural, mechanical, and electrical. And those consultants are hired directly by the owner. Now, one of the concerns architects have is, how can I coordinate everybody's work if I'm not the one paying them, if they're not contracted to me? And the answer is, it's easy. The coordination is totally separate from payment or from contracts. Coordination is a communication task. It's following up and keeping lists and checking for discrepancies. It really doesn't have much to do with payment or anything else like that. There's a good reason why you don't want to have to pay the consultants yourself. One of them is insurance. Your insurance premium for errors and omissions insurance is a function of how much revenue passes through your office. If you are hiring the engineers and have to pay them by being paid and passing that money through, then 50% more money is passing through your office and you're not really using that money, you're just a pass-through. But the insurance premiums are calculated based on how much of that money is passing through. You can reduce your insurance premiums a lot by getting the engineers off your payroll. The other reason, though, is more important. When you have hired the engineers, then your scope of work includes the engineering. If there's a mistake in the engineering, you are liable to the owner, even though the engineer may be liable to you. So the lawsuit the owner files or the arbitration has to be against you, and you'll find yourself embroiled in a claim where you weren't at fault at all. If the owner hires the engineers directly, and one of them screws up and it's clearly just an engineering mistake, then the owner makes his claim against that engineer. He doesn't have to sue you, and you may be able to stay out of the claim or get out of it much less expensively. So there's a good reason not to absorb the liability for your engineers if you don't have to. Another important line is right here just before these general conditions and says that you're entitled to rely on the accuracy of any drawings or other information provided by the owner's consultants. That means that you won't have to double-check their work. You're allowed to rely on it being right, and if something was wrong with it and you incorporate that mistake, say a surveyor shows an underground utility where it isn't, and the contractor digs for it and can't find it and wants extra money for that, even though there's an error on your drawings, it's not your fault, because you are entitled by contract to rely on the accuracy of the survey. An important protective provision. And then we get into what you might consider the fine print or the boilerplate. This architect calls it his general conditions. And it is the business and legal terms, often taken out of the AIA documents or similar to them, but some of them are unique. And I want to take you through them relatively quickly. It's not important that you remember each and every one of these terms, but that you see how you can use them in an agreement of your own when you're in business for yourself or working for an architect who asks you to put the contract together. Paragraph A here talks about the ownership of the drawings and says that the client will have the right to use the drawings for this project only. That is a description of the license, being limited to the project only. And it goes on to say, if the client uses the drawings for any other project, the client has to indemnify the architect. which means hold him harmless and pay the architect back for any loss the architect incurs to a third party who gets upset about the drawings being used elsewhere. The end of paragraph A on the next page contains another developer protection. Developers insist on putting into their contract the right to withhold payment from you if they dispute your entitlement to the payment. They may claim that you're overbilling for your services, or that you've done something that caused the developer damages, like you were late on something, so they're going to withhold that sum from you. Well, that can really screw you up. But the developer has an incentive to invent reasons to do that, because every dollar he withholds from you, he's holding on to and is using to finance his project. So unscrupulous developers will frequently invent all kinds of problems with your billing or your services just to be able to withhold payment from you. This clause says that the developer has to deposit the disputed sum in an escrow account, and that when the dispute is resolved, then the money in the account will go to whoever wins the dispute or however it's settled. But it means that the developer can't keep and use that money for his own purposes, which reduces his incentive to withhold it from you. So now he may not bother to withhold it from you because it's not serving him any useful purpose. Paragraph B is about pricing estimates, and the important part is the section, like the AIA documents, that says that the architect cannot and does not warrant or represent that the prices won't vary from the estimates or the budget. Something making it clear that you're not guaranteeing the construction price, you're just estimating it. Section D talks about your role during construction, and it's very clear that you're just providing periodic site observation. You're not in charge of the work. You're not involved in any kind of safety-related precautions. It's very similar to the AIA language. Down at the bottom of the page and the top of the next page, talking about shop drawings, it says that your review and approval of the shop drawings is conditional on the general contractor having reviewed and approved them first, which is intended to avoid a situation where the contractor is saving money by not even checking his own sub's work and just passing along inadequate drawings to you. That takes you a lot of time to fix, and the general contractor ought to be approving them as being adequate before they're sent to you. The rest of this section is a very long, detailed description of what the architect can and cannot do on the job site. And it's intended to make it very clear to a court that if there is a construction worker accident, that the architect doesn't meet any of the criteria for being responsible for job site safety. These 1 through 10 that you see up here are taken right out of a court case that says, these are the factors you use to determine whether a party is responsible, at least in part, for job site safety. Notice that one of them is 7, that you don't have the right to stop the work. Under the AIA scheme, architects cannot order the work to stop. The most you can do is suggest that the owner order it to stop, and the owner has that right because it's his property, or to suggest that the general contractor order his subs to stop, because they're doing the work wrong and are just going to have to rip out and replace even more. But the architect can't stop the work. Only the owner and general contractor can. Section C is what's called a limitation of liability clause. Whoops. It says that the architect's liability for any kind of claim of malpractice is limited to the sum of the professional fees that the client has paid to you, which is pretty low. I mean, your project, you may earn a $25,000 fee for a house, but if that becomes the limit of your liability, then you're never going to face a very large claim, and insurance companies will lower your premiums if your contracts contain a lot of these kinds of clauses. There is no reason in a contract that you can't agree to limit your liability to whatever number the two parties agree on. Often it's to the limits of your insurance policy. But here, this architect was even more aggressive and limited his liability just to the amount of the fees that he earned for the job. And that's completely doable. Then there's a mediation and arbitration clause here. And then there's a waiver of subrogation. It says that the design professional and client waive all rights against each other and their agents and employees for damages to the extent covered by property insurance. That means that the right for a property insurer to have subrogation claims against anybody disappears. Subrogation, as you recall from last week, is where the insurance company steps into the insured party's shoes to try to recover its loss from anybody who might have caused it, and is a way of fomenting a lot of claims against other parties. Paragraph F is an indemnity clause that's intended to go into the construction contract. Notice the introductory language says that you will put this clause into the construction contract, and the owner agrees not to modify or delete it. And the clause is a long one. It requires the It requires the contractor to indemnify you against typical construction claims. Then we have H, which is the termination and acceptance provision. This is much more liberal than the AIA. According to this contract, either party can terminate for cause, and either party can terminate for convenience. The AIA concept is that only the owner can terminate for convenience. But this architect didn't want to be stuck working with a client he couldn't stand. So he wanted to be able to terminate the project midstream. Then there's an important provision in the second paragraph of H. I'll read it to you and you'll understand it. Client may accept this agreement either by signature, by oral assent, by authorizing the architect to commence providing services, or by making any payments to the architect in consideration of future services, and any of these modes of acceptance shall be deemed to incorporate these general conditions into the contract between the parties. That means that the owner can create a contract just by receiving this proposal and telling the architect to begin work. You now have a contract. Now, it's not a written contract. It's a verbal contract, but with the terms spelled out in this writing. So it's kind of a hybrid between a verbal and a written contract. The owner's, this is the offer, and the owner saying, go ahead and start, is the acceptance. Or making a payment is the acceptance. The owner doesn't have to sign on the bottom line in order for the contract to be accepted. And you'll notice that concept, at the end of this, there's a flowery phrase. Now, if this proposal meets with your approval, we look forward to working with you, etc. And now this looks like a contract signature line. I recommend that there be a signature line just like in a letter that says, very truly yours, comma, Mark Friedlander, comma, principal, ABC Architects, Inc. And then down here in the bottom of the letter, you have another line that says agreed and accepted with the client's name underneath the line. And when he countersigns it by signing his name there, even though it's a letter, not a formal contract, you have a full written contract every bit as protective as the B101, sometimes more so. And if it's a private developer, and the developer says, oh, but the bank needs our B101 contract, and the lawyer marks it up and sends it back to you with impossible provisions in it, you can say, I'm not going to accept these provisions. I already have a contract. This document is my contract. I'll only accept the B101 if its terms are modified consistent with this. And if you're not willing to do that, then under this contract, I have the right to terminate and be paid for everything that you've that I've done already. So this is protection against the owner or the developer playing that contract hide-and-seek game that delays long enough to force you into being in the project but not yet being paid and not yet having your contract signed. Proposal letters are every bit as good contracts as an AIA document. It's what the substance says. The format, whether it's done like a letter or done like a formal written agreement, is irrelevant. Courts don't pay attention to format. They pay attention to substance and to offer and acceptance. And if you have that in a proposal letter, then you have a full contract, which is easier to sell to the client and does a better job of educating the client so that he legitimately knows what he's getting and isn't going to be disappointed when you rely on its terms. Any questions about what we've talked about here today? Or any questions about anything we've done from the midterm on? Because the final is next week. Now remember, some of you are still in the running for the Schiff Hardin Scholarship. The person who does best in this class gets a $1,000 scholarship, care of my law firm, which is what they otherwise would have paid me to teach the class. This is kind of just an honorarium. But it comes out pretty handy when you're on the unemployment line and waiting to hear from a lot of employers for that first job. Otherwise, as I told you, the final will be virtually identical to the midterm in all respects, except that it only deals with the second half of the class. You don't need to restudy what we did in the first half of the class prior to the midterm. It's open book. You can bring anything in with you. Definitely bring your A201 document because there will be questions pertaining to it. It'll be pretty much the same length, multiple choice, just like just like what the midterm was. And you'll probably do better on it than you did on the midterm, because now that you're used to this kind of approach, you'll know what to study for. And just statistically, I found that students do better on the second half of the class. Now, maybe it's because of familiarity. Maybe it's because we're dealing with more construction issues this time and less legal issues, and that's something you're more comfortable and familiar with. Also, there are a few people who didn't get good grades have asked me about the right to write a paper to try to boost their grade. Here's how the paper works. The paper can supplement either or both of your exams, one paper per exam. If you write a paper and do a halfway reasonable job, it can bump your letter grade for the exam up one letter. I'm not allowed to bump it up more than that, but there isn't anybody who did so terribly that they need more than one letter. If you want to try to bump up the midterm and the final each one letter, you can do two papers. The second paper, the one for the final, ought to be on the A201 general conditions, some interesting element of it. You can pick your own topic, but clear it with Mike or me first, because sometimes it's not appropriate. We'll usually approve almost anything halfway reasonable. The papers don't have to be long. I'm talking 3 to 5 pages. It's mostly an excuse for me to be able to give you a better grade. Everything else I try to do to use that excuse, we curve the exam very generously. It's a B to a B-plus curve. If you're on the borderline between two letter grades, right on the borderline, I round up. I think that's pretty much it. I don't want this class to screw up anybody's grade point. On the other hand, what you learn in this class is going to be really important to what you do 3 to 5 years from now, when you're no longer just a bottom person on the totem pole at whatever firm you're working for. And what I recommend you do is to create a file that you just keep as part of your permanent portfolio. You don't have to show it to other people. But all the handouts or the lecture notes that you've had, and maybe even the location of my website, so that if you need to listen to something about some provision of the AIA document, you can go back. I tell you that I get emails from all around the country, usually for architects who are studying for their registration exam, who say that the lectures on the AIA documents are the only ones of their kind in the country, at least the only ones that they can find, and that the only ones that cover them in that degree of detail. And you're going to need to know that for the exam. So if you want to download the WAVE files and keep them on a flash drive or something like that, feel free. You know, yeah, I copyright it, but I'm giving you the license to use them for yourself, for whatever purposes you have, and to share them with other people, other architects who might need them. That's pretty much it. I won't be here next week, but Mike will be to administer the final. We will turn around the grades pretty quickly, within a couple of days, and I will email them out to everybody I have on that mass email list. If there's anybody who's not on that list that I had omitted, just drop me an email today, preferably, so I can add you. But I will be traveling, so Mike will be in charge of distributing the grades. And we're waiting for the surveys to come back so that you can give them feedback on the class. Oh, are they? Mike, you want to let her in? Thank you. I didn't realize that. I was waiting for another knock on the door.
And if you guys do want to do for the second exam, you need to write something, let us know fairly quickly after you get your grade so we can start the process here. We'll have some deadlines and we'll be sure it's going to be a problem.
Yeah. Oh, one other thing. Those of you who have, you know, participated in class and asked the good questions, if I can find an excuse to bump you up if you're close, it will definitely count in your favor. So, actually, this is one of the few years where I can't remember any stupid questions at all. Usually, I have to bite my tongue with some of the questions and not embarrass whoever asked it, but you guys never forced me to do that. So maybe it's a smart class that's going to do real well on the final. Again, no one's going to get a perfect paper on the final. No one ever does, but it'll be well curved, so don't sweat it. Thanks again. We've enjoyed the year, and best of luck on the job, Marshall.